Novus, the new voice. Vox Novus, the new dimension. Vox Novus, thought and movement leaders who will share from their experience and offer tools to help us navigate our rapidly changing world. My name is Victor Furman. Welcome to Vox Novus, the new voice. Wednesday, January 27th, is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. It is observed as a day of commemoration for the approximately 6 million Jews and 5 million others who perished in the Holocaust. What many are not aware of is the Nazi slaughter of those with physical or mental disabilities in what they called the T4, or euthanasia program, part of their maniacal attempt at racial purity. My guest this week on Vox Novus, Sylvia True, has written a heartbreaking, compelling, and revelatory novel based upon her own family's experience that reflects the stigma associated with mental illness and the inherent danger in a culture that dehumanizes others. Sylvia True was born in England to parents who were refugees from Germany. She moved to the U.S. when she was 5. Growing up with parents from different cultures, a mother who was a Swiss champion figure skater, and a father who was a theoretical nuclear physicist, gave her varied and unique perspectives. During her summer breaks, Sylvia likes to travel the Amazon and do research in the rainforest. She has raised 2 daughters who are both pursuing their passions. Presently, she lives in Massachusetts with her husband, 2 very spoiled dogs, and there she teaches high school chemistry. Her first book was entitled The Wednesday Group. Her website is sylviatrue.com, and she joins me this week to discuss her latest book, Where Madness Lies. Please welcome to Vox Novus, Sylvia True. Welcome, Sylvia.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me today. Sylvia, please share with our listeners about your path and experience growing up.
So both of my parents fled from Germany. They were actually born in the same town in Frankfurt. They were both from Frankfurt, Germany. And my mother's family fled to Switzerland, and my father's family fled to England. And my mother met my father later on in England. They married. And my father came to the U.S. to do a sabbatical in theoretical nuclear physics, and we ended up staying here. And so it was a very interesting family to grow up in, very, very intellectual, scientific on one hand. And on the other hand, I think there were a lot of things that were put down, repressed, kept hidden, that definitely affected me as a child and absolutely affected me as an adult. So I had to go through sort of my own difficult time in my 20s. I ended up in a mental hospital with depression that was partly from a postpartum depression when my daughter was born, but also was because of a long, you know, history of repression, anxiety, that led to that.
Where Madness Lies is a story about the high price of repression in Nazi Germany. How does the link to your grandmother and your own family?
Sure. So my grandmother was in Frankfurt, and they were a wealthy family and, you know, aristocratic family. And my grandmother had a sister named Rigmor, and sadly, Rigmor had some mental illness. Exactly what she had is not completely clear, because at the time, in that time in Germany, a lot of people were given the diagnosis of schizophrenia, where we would not give that today. And she was diagnosed with hysteria and depression. And my grandmother did absolutely everything she could to help her sister. You know, she researched, they found the best doctors. Rigmor ended up in supposedly the best institution in Germany. And, you know, all of that didn't save Rigmor, basically. And my grandmother had to leave the country. And I think when my grandmother left, she left without her husband. She was married to my grandfather, who happened not to be Jewish. And he was a chemist. And in order for him to stay at the university he was at, he couldn't be married to somebody who was Jewish. So she left Germany with her mother and her daughter and, you know, sort of lost everything. Her, you know, her high society, you know, standing. She lost her sister. They lost a lot of money, obviously. And I think that led to a need to sort of close off. I'm going to put it like that, and repress what had happened. And because of that, she also became a kind of controlling, rigid person, which sounds mean to say, but I think did happen to her. You know, for example, she had a bunch of clocks in her house. All the clocks had to go off at exactly the same time every day. And again, not that that's a sign of anything necessarily, but, you know, she controlled what she could because so much had been out of her control, right? So, you know, she, when we were raised by her to a large degree. We spent all of our summers in Switzerland, you know, and we were judged on our table manners and all these crazy little things. And the big things were really kept secret. And underlying, I think, everything was a tremendous amount of fear and shame as well.
Women were treated differently then, weren't they?
I believe so, yes.
When a woman came in with any type of issue, it was called hysteria, which was a...
Yes, absolutely.
And I believe that was a term that was coined by Freud, right?
You know, I'm not 100% sure. So, yes, there was a lot of people looked at women as certainly less than. And the other interesting thing, well, one of the many interesting things, is that women, and I know this is true about Freud, were thought, women didn't have like orgasms like men did. And if they had this hysteria, one of the treatments was for them to go to a doctor and have a vaginal, what they called a vaginal massage until they had some kind of, you know, some kind of, not a seizure, but some kind of awakening, I guess. And that was the treatment for hysteria. That was one of the treatments. And then when vibrators were discovered, doctors were super relieved that they could now, you know, do it electronically. And eventually the vibrators were used in porn. And then that was like, that treatment was wiped out. So it's kind of interesting, the labels that women did get put on them.
But women were treated absolutely horrendously as compared to their male counterparts when it came to any type of mental illness.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. You know, they're weaker, supposedly.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And hysterical,
yeah.
Supposedly.
Yeah, yeah. A very easy label for a man to put on someone else. It's just...
right.
And unfortunately,
right.
And unfortunately, not completely missing from our society today.
No, it's funny that you said that, because I think people still use that word, hysterical, and, you know, hysterectomy. You think about, she has a hysterectomy, that comes from the word hysterical. You know, it's definitely a demeaning thing to say to a woman.
Absolutely. What was the Nazi practice of eugenics, and how did it lead to the horrendous acts that they committed?
So eugenics is fascinating. It was, the term eugenics was coined in 1888 by Sir Francis Galton. And it was really about biology, right? And sort of looking at a race of anything, really, and trying to weed out the disease and the illness. So, I mean, if you look at it from that perspective, it doesn't feel like anything necessarily horrifying. And In the 1920s, there were many eugenic societies all around the world. You know, it certainly wasn't Germany who came up with that. In fact, the U.S. at some point was, you know, ahead of Germany in their sterilization. So, you know, the Germans believed it. The German doctors believed it. It was about purifying the race. And obviously, the Nazis took it to such an obscene end. But in 1933 in Germany, they adopted a sterilization act, which in which, people with all sorts of things, mostly what mental illness, but they called it feeble-mindedness, schizophrenia, congenital deafness, blindness, even alcoholism, people were sterilized for. And they sterilized in Germany from 34 to 39, about 400,000 people. So, even though, other countries were on the eugenics bandwagon, Germany took it to this crazy, obscene end. And I think, the eugenics and the sterilization movement led to then the murder of mental patients. And in many ways, I think that the murder of the mental patients was the Nazis' opening act, because what happened was there were six big sanatoriums, one of them which my grandmother's sister was in, who built gas chambers in their hospitals. And these gas chambers were the same design, and the same doctors from those mental institutions went to the concentration camps and built those similar type of gas chambers. So the murder of the mentally ill, like I said, I think it's the opening act. And they chose their victims, they murdered them, they burned the bodies, they pillaged the corpses, and that was kind of where it began, and led to, the horrific end it became.
And the euphemism they used was disinfecting.
Yes, they were the people were disinfected, right? Because it was the illness was an infection on society,
And in essence, they marched them into the gas chambers, turned on the carbon monoxide, and they all died. And people who we know of in the last 20 or 25 years as being on the autism spectrum, would it have been included in that group, correct?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they absolutely would have.
What they had used to refer to as feeble-mindedness, that people who might not emote or people who might not communicate well automatically would have been grouped in.
The feeble-mindedness label can, that can cover a huge part of the population. I mean, so many things would have been considered feeble-minded. I mean, it's a pretty horrid word, I think.
In a way, and we'll talk about this a little more later, we still haven't, as a society, and you think we would have matured by this point, gotten to the point where we stop labeling others who are slightly different than we are.
I mean, that is absolutely, that's so true. I mean, labels, it's interesting, because when you think about labels, I mean, once in a while, I mean, they can be useful, right? Like, and this isn't a label, but I'm just going to throw this one out here. Like, you have diabetes. Well, is that a label? No, it's a diagnosis. And it's helpful to place that on somebody if that's what they have, because then you can get the right kind of help. So, you think about things that, depression or what have you. I mean, sometimes those, and again, quote unquote labels, diagnoses can be really, really useful. But for the most part, there are all sorts of labels that are just so unhelpful in society. And I think we're seeing that in a huge way right now. I'm not going to get into politics, but I mean, the way people label each other and blame each other, it's causing so much divisiveness in our culture.
Yeah, and when the labels are used to demean or make someone lesser than you, that's what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
In your novel, Where Madness Lies, the names have been changed, and some of the details are how you imagine them, but the basics of the story, the insides, are true. Can you give us more information about the true scope, I'm sorry, the true scope of this incredibly tragic part of our history?
So, really, much of it, or I would say most of it's true, in terms of what happened to my grandmother in Germany and her sister. The fictionalized part, it's kind of interesting, is because many people who fled from Germany did not, you know, at that time, did not share a lot of what happened to them. And in my case, it's kind of interesting how it all came about because, as I said earlier, I struggled from major depression. And after my first child was born, I ended up in a hospital called McLean Hospital outside of Boston. It's, you know, it was a very well known hospital. And I got tremendous treatment. It was one of the best educations in my life. I mean, I was super fortunate. But when I first went there, my mother and my grandmother were just terrified. My mother couldn't speak to me. It was, you know, whether it was part fear, it was part shame. You know, we were brought up, we had to always look perfect, act perfect. I mean, people still deal with that today. So eventually, my grandmother sort of slowly revealed what had happened to her and her sister. And in doing that, I mean, it helped me so tremendously to know that I wasn't alone, that this was part of the family history. I didn't need to be ashamed. And it sort of brought us all, and I, this is going to sound a little cheesy, but it sort of like brought us all into the light, you know, that honesty and that final opening up of the secrets allowed us to move forward in a much more loving way.
To understand that the heritage exists and that this is something that is not peculiar to you must have been tremendously opening for you.
I mean, yeah, that was incredibly healing, because I think when you feel, I mean, depression, you already feel isolated, alone, and hopeless. And to really understand the dynamics of what happened in the family was unbelievably helpful. And I'm so grateful for my mother and grandmother for eventually sharing it. To get back to sort of, I did a little bit of a tangent there, but to get back to what's true and what's not true. So basically, because many people of my grandmother's generation didn't share a lot, there are pieces that I had to sort of piece together. I mean, she shared the big pieces and the big sort of quote unquote secrets, but some of the other historical piece, you know, I did a lot of work research and made sure that it was accurate in terms of what was going on in Germany.
You know, I think that nature of secrecy did not just apply to those in the circumstances that your grandmother and your mother had to survive. I think that was something that was very common in the 40s and 50s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, even things like divorce, and I mean, they were all like shameful things. Like, I remember some neighbor of ours got divorced, and I mean, my mother was just like whispered about it, like it was some horribly shameful thing. And again, that, you know, and I don't know how much stem from Germany, and it's true in so many families that, you know, we all have to put on a certain act and we all have to pretend we're fine and perfect and nothing's wrong. And, you know, that obviously doesn't help the people in the family, but it doesn't help anybody in society, really. I mean, another real theme, I think, of the book is that the grandmother and the granddaughter both have to sort of come to the table and be very honest about who they are, how they feel, and really learn to understand each other and have empathy, you know, instead of making all the prejudgments that they both made. And I think that's true everywhere we look today. You know, it's so disheartening in this country to see all the divisiveness. And, you know, you just want people to come to the table and actually talk to each other and listen and understand where they're coming from. And that understanding and that empathy is what ultimately, I think, gives the story in the book hope, you know, hope that we can connect and we can love each other.
Absolutely. My guest is Sylvia True. She's the author of Where Madness Lies. Sylvia, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you.
Oh, sure. You can go to my website at sylviatrue.com, and the book's available on any, you know, Amazon, Barnes and Noble. You just can Google it and it'll pop right up.
And we'll be back with more of Sylvia after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
The best of the holistic, spiritual, and conscious world. OM Times Radio. IOM FM. OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of OM Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What is Going On? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
Look out, world, we're getting strong. The future's here and we belong.
She can sail, she can do more.
Like build a rocket and watch it soar.
We'll clean the oceans and make the world a better place. Oh,
she can sail, so can you.
Find a cure.
Learn more at She Can STEM, a message brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that we can give our daughters everything they need to grow and learn, but not every child can focus on classes and play dates.
Nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. face hunger. That's 1 in 6. School lunch might be their only meal each day, and it's heartbreaking to imagine any child going to bed hungry. We're dreaming of a perfect day when kids can smile, play, and just be kids without worrying about where their next meal will come from. Feeding America is working to make that perfect day a reality.
Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste. That food is given to families and children in need. Being a kid should be about doing things that make an ordinary day extraordinary. Learning to play an instrument, building a sandcastle, hosting tea parties. Hunger should never be an obstacle to growing up.
You can help end childhood hunger in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
Back on Vox Novus, my guest this week is Sylvia True, the author of Where Madness Lies. Sylvia, was your grandfather the doctor of Anne Frank's family?
Yes, my grandfather on my father's side, again in Frankfurt, he was the doctor of the Frank family. They were sort of the intellectual Jewish group. That was, obviously the Frank family fled to Amsterdam, and my father's family fled to England. And my grandfather was such a kind, and I remember him well. He was a very kind and soft sort of soul. And he absolutely did not believe that anything terrible was going to happen in Germany. And he didn't believe humans would act that way. And he sort of got pushed onto a train, literally pushed onto a train by his cousin, to get him out of there. And he did, and my father's family, for the most part, made it out. But he did not believe that humans could be the way, sadly, humans turned out to be.
Did your grandparents on either side ever discuss with you about anti-Semitism?
What a great question. Not much at all. But what was interesting is when we came to this country, my father was an atheist, you know, and almost till the end of his life. He died about a year ago. But my mother took us, dropped us off at a Lutheran church in the town we grew up in. It was outside of Chicago. And basically so that we could, quote unquote, pass, right? When we were with non-Jewish people, we were Christians. And when we were with Jewish people, we were Jewish. But they never really brought up a lot about anti-Semitism. You know, I think my mother was much more of the belief that, you know, you're a chameleon. You can fit in wherever you're, you know, wherever you're put, you fit in there.
It's interesting. You would think that there would be cautionary tales.
Right. No. No. It was more of, you know, you can fit in wherever we put you.
Did you, as you were growing, have an understanding of the Holocaust?
Oh, absolutely not. None. Because it was not spoken about. It was, you know, my father would talk about how wonderful his childhood was, which wasn't. It wasn't. I mean, he was, you know, beaten and bullied and tortured in Germany before they fled. It was not discussed. That was sort of rule number one. I mean, rule number one was we don't discuss the past or those painful things. Rule number two is you better be perfect. You know, you don't show any emotional weakness. I was kind of a quote unquote sensitive or oversensitive child. I don't know what that even means. I tend to think that's a good thing, you know, to be sensitive, but it wasn't looked at it as a good thing. I was too sensitive and I needed to pull up my socks.
Yep. I heard that when I was growing up. Is mental health something we inherit? You wrote an essay in Psychology Today suggesting this.
Well, I think that it's really an interesting point to consider. I remember when I went to college forever ago and I took a class and I was told that 80% was of who you are was environmental and 20% was genetic. And I think we all know now that those numbers are not really accurate. You know, I can't put a number on it. Can I say it's 50-50? I don't really know. I do know that people, you know, there's been a lot of research and it's clear that there are certain things, certain mental illnesses that run in families, and in my family, certainly depression ran in my family, and both my daughters have depression, although differently than I have it. One of them is more on the depressed side, and the other is more about anxiety, and I was fortunate to get both depression and anxiety. But what's beautiful is if you look over time, you know, and you think about what happened to my great aunt in, you know, Nazi Germany and how mental illness was treated then to now. And, you know, there's still shame around it and there's still stigma around it. But, you know, my daughters have absolutely no problem getting help and being fine, you know, and they don't care. It's not a shameful thing. So it's great to see that progression over time.
And depression is something that a lot more men are opening up about.
Right. Right. And all that can do, that openness is just going to help other people. You know, the more open you are about it, I think the more people feel comfortable and say, yeah, I sometimes feel that way too. I wonder if there is help, or, you know, I sometimes have those thoughts about killing myself or whatever, you know, and to know that you can talk about it and it's not shameful and there's so much help out there. I mean, I teach high school and I want my students to know that, you know, that this is, you know, mental health is not, if you're not feeling great, it's not something to be ashamed of. And, you know, there's lots of support.
So we as a culture, as a country, are dealing better with mental health now than they were 80 years ago.
Yeah, I absolutely. Does it mean everything's perfect? No. But yeah, I think we've come a long way. I mean, I still notice, it's funny, I still notice little things, especially, you know, at school as a teacher. You know, if a student's not doing well and I hear from one of the counselors, and we have wonderful counselors, it's still a little bit whispered about. When I say whispered about, I mean, you still feel, you know, it's like still something that's a little bit shameful, but not the way it was, you know. But yeah, I think there's still some shame around it.
And what message would you have from someone who was suffering some form of mental illness?
Just be open about it and know that there is great help, whether it's, you know, medicine, therapy, or going to a psychic. And if the first person, you know, doesn't help you, or you don't feel like that's a good fit, just don't stop trying. You know, part of depression is feeling so hopeless. And so you have to tell yourself, you know, it's not hopeless. You have to remind yourself it's not hopeless. And there is incredible help out there.
Now, you mentioned seeing a psychic. You have a strong belief in what's been labeled the paranormal, and there's a character in your book who has visions. It's clear that these are paranormal visions. Is that what you hope the reader will think too?
Well, yes. I think I do hope the reader will think that, but it's also a little bit ambiguous. I mean, you know, if somebody's not ready to see it that way, they can maybe see her as mentally ill. And it's interesting because there are people who have visions and hear voices who are put in mental hospitals. And I'm not, you know, obviously every case is different. And I am not here to be a doctor and diagnose. But, you know, sometimes those people are really having psychic, you know, paranormal visions and are certainly the furthest thing from crazy. So, yeah, I was really fortunate. After I was in McLean, I came out of McLean and I felt so free for the first time in my life. You know, I wasn't like burdened with this enormous depression. And I decided, you know, to sort of open up to many different things. And in my family, I come from, you know, they're just tons of scientists, right? Geneticists and physicists and doctors and, you know, and believing in something like psychics was really poo-pooed and looked down on. But I had the fortune of not running into this person. I met somebody whose mother was psychic. And at first, when this person told me about his mother, I was like, oh, that's nonsense. I was, you know, just believing what my family had taught me. But I was curious, right? So I thought, all right, I'll go. And I met this woman named Sophie who read regular cards, not tarot cards. I mean, we call them playing cards, but playing cards were actually, I'm sure you know, they were invented to do readings for fortune telling. Anyway, so I met this woman, Sophie, and I was completely blown away on my first reading ever. There were so many specific detail things that she couldn't have known that she knew. And I was so curious. And I followed that curiosity. And it's interesting because I would, you know, I was like, oh, I can believe in psychics now, but I certainly don't believe in mediums, as if there was a big difference. I mean, I look back and I was still, you know, it took years for me to sort of say, okay, well, let's see what the medium thing is all about. And then I started doing more and more reading and researching, and I find it fascinating. And it's a huge part of my life and my growth, you know. And I absolutely know that there are people out there, very gifted people, who have these gifts, and they're there to help. They're there to help people like me or anybody.
Have you had any experiences with the paranormal or visions?
Well, I have dreams that I always had them. But again, you know, used to think, well, that's just a coincidence that I have a dream that then it is exactly what happens, you know, the next day. I would say that what my experiences have been is through my readings, from mostly from Sophie, but I also, you know, when I was in my most curious stage, I mean, I just wanted to see every medium that ever existed. Some, you know, and many of them were unbelievably good. And I did run up against a few frauds as well, which is really disheartening, because I feel like they give the whole thing a bad name. And, you know, so many people are just ready to say, oh, that's a bunch of nonsense, because they heard of one or two frauds, and there are frauds out there. And then they just dismiss the whole thing. And it's such an interesting thing to me in our culture, how close-minded, I'm going to use that word, how close-minded so many people are about this. It's if you go to different cultures, like I, you know, in Peru, where I visit in the jungle, I mean, they believe, you know, the spirit is in the wind and the trees. And also, I mean, they believe in things like a family can claim that another family put a curse or a hex on them, and the police will actually investigate it. And here we find that almost laughable. And it's just that we are so close to that. I mean, in India, they, you know, believe in reincarnation. And if a child remembers something of a past life and they have enough details, they'll go and seek out that family for the child. And, you know, they have a big celebration around it. And so I feel like, you know, I don't know, we need to be more open about it and see what's out there. There are mountains of data. The University of Virginia, they do so much amazing research on this. And, you know, there's just so much data, and yet people still are like, yeah, that can't be, or it's a coincidence.
Well, my path has been the crossroads of science and spirituality. And what I've come to learn, especially in the last 15 or 20 years, with the revelations of quantum mechanics, is that they're not mutually exclusive, that there's actually going to be a day when science can explain all of this.
Right. I believe that too. I think because I'm a chemistry teacher, I teach the AP Chem. I mean, we do talk about quantum mechanics. And quantum mechanics is obviously extremely complicated. But yeah, The beauty of quantum mechanics is that it allows the possibility to exist, right? Whereas classical physics has nothing to do with that. But in quantum mechanics, you know, they are not necessarily mutually exclusive.
Einstein referred to it as spooky action at a distance.
Right.
Why did you add the paranormal layer to your book?
For a number of reasons. I mean, one is obviously it's a really important part of who I am. But I also thought it was really important, especially for my grandmother's character, Inga, to sort of to push that boundary a little, because Inga's whole growth throughout the novel is basically to open up the secrets in the past. But there's another openness that has to go on too. And it's, you know, it sort of forces her to be like, oh, maybe this is also there. And at the end of her journey, she has a vision of her sister. Now she also has a fever. So, you know, the reader can think, well, that's just a fever that's a hallucination from a fever. But, for me, it's also about the connection of the past generations and the future generations. I mean, time is such an interesting phenomena, right? I mean, is time really linear, or are we all connected from past into future? And so it was about that connection as well.
My guest is Sylvia True. She's the author of Where Madness Lies. We'll be back with more of Sylvia after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose: to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free. AscendingHearts.com.
America, your children have an amazing superpower. They can help save lives by not having playdates. That's right. By replacing get-togethers with virtual playdates and video chats, they can help slow the evil spread of germs. And if your superheroes do go outside, make sure they continue their superhero wing by staying 6 feet away from others to protect everyone in America land. Find out more at coronavirus.gov. A message from the CDC and the Ad Council.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with, all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up, like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
Know that feeling? Like every door is closing and you just can't see a way out? Being unemployed, underemployed, or just out of school can feel like that. But when you find the right tools, suddenly everything just clicks. FindSomethingNew.org offers resources that help develop new skills. Skills that can position you for careers in today's growing industries, from healthcare and manufacturing to cybersecurity and alternative energy. Find your path to a new career at FindSomethingNew.org. A message from the Ad Council.
Coping 19, brought to you by CDC and the Ad Council.
With so much loss, you may feel like you can't handle it all. Meditation or other spiritual practices can help you feel more grounded and better able to cope.
Find more self-care and coping tips at coping-19.org.
Why was the basketball court all wet? Because the players kept dribbling on it.
The dad joke. Corny, groan-worthy, but also one of the simplest ways to share a moment with your kids.
What did the buffalo say when he dropped his son off for school?
Bye, son.
So take a moment to make your kid laugh, because dad jokes rule. Make your kid laugh today. Go to fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Back on Vox Novus, my guest this week is Sylvia True. She's the author of Where Madness Lies. In the last segment, you were talking about your experiences in getting readings from Sophie. Is there one specific story you'd like to share?
Sure. There are many stories I have with Sophie. In fact, that's my next sort of book I'm working on, is my spiritual journey, but it's my spiritual journey through some of the most fascinating readings that I don't know that I've ever encountered. But anyway, there's one in particular that I think is sort of charming, I guess. And my eldest daughter was pregnant with her first granddaughter, and she was very nervous, a nervous pregnant woman, because she had recently had a miscarriage. So it was there was a lot of anxiety, and she went and had an ultrasound. It was on New Year's Eve, and I remember because I was in Chicago visiting my dad, and she was here in Boston, and she called me, and she couldn't even speak. She was so absolutely hysterical, just crying and, you know, And the technician had said something to her that she interpreted as the baby has an enlarged artery in its head. And I was like, whoa, that doesn't make sense. And I understood absolutely why Erica was panicked and worried. And I was like, artery in the head? I don't know what that means. And I have a number of doctors in my family. And so I got off the phone with Erica and probably should have called probably not, but you know, I could have called the doctor and a radiologist, but no, I call Sophie, my psychic. And Sophie lays out a few cards for me and she's like, absolutely nothing is wrong with that baby. That baby's fine. But Erica cannot have sex for 2 weeks. Something that's going to move hasn't moved yet. And you have to tell her she can't have sex for 2 weeks. And I was like, well, I'm not going to tell her that, but I'm just going to be relieved that Sophie sees the baby is fine, right? Now, did I know 100% that was true? No, I didn't, but it definitely calmed me that down and, you know, I could calm Erica down a little. So then Erica went to her doctor and her doctor was like, no, the baby's totally fine. There's, you know, the technician has said there's an artifact in the reading, because it's a sonogram, right? So, you know, sometimes you can get disturbances. So it was absolutely nothing to do with the baby. It was something else, an artifact. And then he said, but your placenta is low-lying. It hasn't moved yet. And it'll probably move, you know, it'll take a couple weeks. And if you do choose to have sex in the next couple weeks, it'll probably bleed a little. It's no big deal. And if you panic, just come here and get another ultrasound. It's fine. And of course, you know, Erica chose to have sex and had a little spotting and had to go get another ultrasound. But that Sophie knew exactly, you know what I mean? Like something hadn't moved. It would take 2 weeks to move. And there are so many stories I have like that. I mean, that she knew that specificity of detail just blows me away.
Yeah. We've come to witness great division in our country and the once undercurrent of white supremacy, racism, and anti-Semitism are now fully exposed. How can Where Madness Lies help us as we head into an uncertain future?
Oh, yeah. Discourse, I do believe it's about talking to each other and understanding, you know, where the other people are coming from. And one of my favorite quotes, and this has to do with certainty and uncertainty, it's, you know, only a closed mind is certain. And I just believe so much in keeping an open mind, whether it's about mental illness or spirituality. But mostly now it's about trying to talk to the other, maybe not the other side. There aren't only two sides. There are many sides. But try to come up with some understanding or figure out what is going on. And instead of just blaming and pointing fingers, but to really, we really need to stop and talk to each other and listen to each other. Because I think we're all baffled about a number of things that are going on. And there are times when I'm like, I just want to talk to them. Like, I just don't get it. You know, what on earth are they thinking? So I do think it's about conversation, and it would be great if we talked to each other more and pointed fingers less.
Do you think a lot of this comes as a basis of disenfranchisement or sensed disenfranchisement?
From disenfranchisement from?
The groups that are feeling this, that are reacting in this way, have a sense of being disenfranchised, and unfortunately certain politicians have played to that.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and, you know, it's funny that also brings, I mean, maybe they feel like they're not being listened to, or, you know, they feel like other groups get more advantages or preferred. And again, it comes down to really trying to understand each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And listening. I think listening is the most important.
Right. Right.
Philosopher George Santayana said, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Do we need curriculums in our schools to teach about this very dark part of our history?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, we to understand where we are at the moment in our lives on all levels, like where you are personally at the moment, where you are in, you know, your country at the moment. You have to, it's all based on the past, right? You know, we're here because of what happened before us. And yeah, we do need to always look, reflect, and understand what happened before us so we don't repeat the same mistakes. And I mean, I think that that's one of the hopes that I want for this book is, you know, the mistakes of keeping things repressed, the mistakes of keeping secrets, the mistakes of, you know, trying to be perfect or to show perfection, you know, that those aren't repeated. And, you know, and with my daughter's, you know, inkling of depression or anxiety, I was like, okay, we're going to get help, you know, and that's in order not to repeat the past. So, and they know, they're, like I said earlier, they don't have shame over, you know, any kind of mental illness the way I did.
Now, you're a chemistry teacher. You are an educator. Do you see that in the schools today, that there's any kind of curriculum being developed to help us remember?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I'm in Massachusetts, so it's, you know, we're a pretty liberal school district. But yes, I definitely see that. And they're bringing in more and more curriculum that addresses more recent issues as well, which is nice to see, you know, and especially in the English department, I think bringing in newer voices in literature, not just some of the things we used to only study, like Shakespeare or whatever. They're bringing in all the new voices as well. And that's very refreshing and hopeful.
That's wonderful to hear. You have some wonderful pictures in your book. What are the significance of those pictures?
Well, those were the real people. And I love when books have, whether they're illustrations or photos, you know, it just adds another dimension, another layer. You get the real visual. I mean, hopefully you get the visual from the words, and hopefully the words sort of match the pictures. But it's just another layer and a fun way to, you know, connect with the characters in the book.
There's been a lot of, in the last few years, the onset of ancestry websites where you send your DNA samples in and they connect you to your past and your history. You think those things are important?
I do. I think they've been incredible for, I mean, I've heard some great stories from people who, you know, some people who find their biological parents and some people who connect to different relatives they didn't know were out there. So yeah, I think those are great. And you can learn, again, you can learn a lot too about, you know, I don't want to bring it down to something depressing, but you can learn a lot about disease and, you know, what runs in the family.
Absolutely. You've touched upon a few of these. Give me a message that you'd like readers to take away from Where Madness Lies.
I guess it would be only a closed mind is certain. So just an open-mindedness to listen to people who want to share their stories and to learn from that.
One of the things that I impress upon those that I'm with is the art of sacred listening. And what sacred listening is creating a space for someone to speak their truth without interruption, without opinion, and to listen with an ear of not only knowledge, but an ear of compassion. Is that something we need to teach our kids?
Yes. Oh, my God. That was so beautifully said, Victor. I want that written down. Yes, absolutely. Most important thing in my mind. Because then that opens up so many possibilities. Possibilities of connection, of hope, of love.
Absolutely. And not only to teach our children how to listen, but we should learn again how to listen to our children.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely.
Because from our kids come some of the most pure, unfiltered, and genuine wisdom we can ever hear.
That's so true. Right. Especially the young ones. And the young ones are often the ones who also have, you know, like you described earlier, the visions. And yeah, we have to pay attention to that. Not dismiss that.
Absolutely. What's next for Sylvia True?
So, like I said earlier, I think I'm working on these stories, a collection of stories of different, not just readings, but interactions I've had with psychics and mediums and, you know, where that's brought me.
Really quickly, your first book was called The Wednesday Group. What was that about?
Oh, that was all, very similar in a way. In theme, it's about a group of women who end up together in a group therapy session because all of their husbands have different sorts of sex addiction. But it's really, again, about the openness and about letting go of the shame and making the connections in order to move forward, you know, with a more peaceful soul, I guess. Yes. So it's, in many ways, I mean, it's a very different book, but the core is kind of similar.
My guest, Sylvia True, her book, Where Madness Lies. Sylvia, one more time, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you.
Sure. SylviaTrue.com is my website. You can go on Barnes & Noble or Amazon or BookBub, any of those sites. You'll be able to find it there as well.
Sylvia, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your story.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And thank you for joining us on Vox Novus. I'm Victor, the voice, Furman. Have a wonderful week.